Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is Sarah Carson. I'll be talking with Sarah about her poetry collection, Buick City, published in 2015 by May Apple Press. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm talking today via Skype with Sarah Carson. Sarah Carson's newest book of poems, Buick City, was published in 2015 by May Apple Press. She also is the author of the collection Poems in Which You Die from Batcat Press in 2014 and three chapbooks. Her poems and short stories have appeared in Columbia Poetry Review, Cream City Review, Diagram, Guernica, and the Nashville Review, among others. Hello, Sarah. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, and I'm excited to talk about your book, Buick City, and I'm hopeful that your puppy and my cats will not try to disrupt the interview.
Yes, well, we shall see what happens. He looks like he's ready to disrupt at any minute.
Yeah, and thinking of my cats, I like mentally they don't care at all right now, and in about 5 or 10 minutes it's going to hit them. My God, the door is shut in his study. We've got to get in there. He's probably doing something without us, and we have to be part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
They do it. They're the biggest fans of the podcast. So we'll see. Let's get started talking about the book. One of my favorite subjects to talk about on the show is the question of how our books are constructed. Sort of how we shape a collection as a whole. And I know that when we read, I just jump back and forth. When I'm reading a book of poems, but there is, I'm always aware, especially if I do read start to finish, that there is a start to finish narrative arc that's really important, a narrative arc or like what Doug Kearney calls a macro poem. And, in terms of your macro poem, it's divided into 5 distinct sections, with the third section, Hall's Flats, a long serial poem, serving as a kind of bridge between 1 and 2 and 4 and 5. And I want to talk about Hall's Flats in more detail in a little bit. But for now, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you constructed the book's overall narrative arc or overall macro poem.
Sure. Yeah. It's always interesting to me when I hear other people say that they jump around when they read a book of poetry, because I just don't do that. And it never occurred to me to do that. I always start at the beginning and just go straight through. So I guess when I put this book together, this was a book of poems that I was working on in graduate school. It was kind of the first collection of poems that I ever kind of thought about as being a book. And they're pretty autobiographical in nature. There's some stuff that's fictionalized, but most of it is pretty true. So I kind of arranged them pretty chronologically so that I hope that it kind of comes across as almost like a coming of age kind of thing. Of course, it stops still pretty young. I was like 25 or 26. So, that was kind of the idea. And then the 5 sections that you talked about. So the book is called Buick City. Buick City really literally is the name of the factory where my father worked, because he built Buicks his whole life, or my whole life, I guess. I'm from Flint, Michigan. They call Flint Vehicle City. So I kind of just, I guess, superimposed one on the other and just called the book Buick City. Uh-huh. So the 5 sections are all kind of neighborhoods or maybe areas. Like the first one is called Indian Hills, which is actually a trailer park where my parents lived when I was born. And then there's other ones. Hall's Flats is just a small neighborhood. So they're not all like places I actually lived, but all places that I kind of had a connection to. So I just thought I didn't take it all incredibly literally. I think things kind of flow back and forth between time periods and places, but I kind of used neighborhoods as a way to kind of create some semblance of a narrative, I guess, that tries to go throughout the book.
So kind of like the sections are corresponding to narratives, but or I'm sorry, the sections are corresponding to neighborhoods, and then they form this longer or this larger narrative that's kind of like the whole city.
Yeah, I think that's what I tried to do. I don't think that you necessarily need to know much about those neighborhoods in order for the poems in those sections to make sense, but I liked the idea of breaking it up in a way that you felt like maybe you were moving from place to place, because some of the poems are like very clearly autobiographical, while others are maybe more of like a narrative about a person I knew, or just kind of a third person little snapshot into someone's life. And so I kind of tried to create it in a way that maybe as you read through the book, you felt like you were kind of getting to know people in this town and in these separate maybe places in the town, or places where they worked or they lived or people they knew or things like that.
It is interesting when you're talking about like giving us these profiles of the people in the larger city of the book, if I can just keep extending that metaphor, like the folks that are in the book as the city, it's interesting because like a couple things come to mind. Number one, when you were talking earlier about how you read a book of poems from start to finish, and the book, the narrative arc works so well start to finish. Like I do feel that chronological sense that especially as I get toward the end, like the poem, I Can't Sleep in the Back Bedroom. It feels like we've sort of hit a penultimate moment in the book of nostalgia and the present moment and looking forward all at the same time. And then at the same time, with all of the people in all of the neighborhoods, I still get a meandering feel, like I'm meandering through a larger city. Like I am, you know, I could go from neighborhood one to neighborhood two, section one to two, but I also could meander. Oh, is that the puppy?
Yeah,
that's fantastic. For a moment, I thought there was something wrong with my Skype connection.
Oh.
What's the puppy's name?
Abel.
Hello, Abel. Good to have you on the show. We're going to ask you a question later, so be ready. But then I also feel like I could go from section one to section four, and it's like I am going from, you know, one neighborhood in a city to another neighborhood. I guess what I'm saying is I kind of like how I often call the larger scope of a book of poems the narrative arc. But hey, Abel, but in Buick City, it almost feels like we're talking about a map. Like it really is a map of a city rather than, it doesn't have to be a narrative arc. It could be like a larger map of a landscape.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that I've thought about it like that, but I like that idea, the map idea. When I was laying out the poems, because obviously I certainly didn't write them this way. Like I know some people have an idea for a book and start to say, oh, I need a poem that's kind of like this to kind of fill the book out. And that's not the way I did this at all. It's, you know, I had these poems and I was like, how's the best way to kind of lead someone through these poems, I think. So once you get to maybe the fourth section, once you get kind of past the Hull's Flat, like serial poem, as you called it, there start to be poems that are really about like identity as an adult, having grown up in this place and kind of struggling with the ideas of what it will mean to be someone with a certain set of experiences who, you know, ultimately at the very end of the book, I hope it's clear that the narrator kind of leaves the city and is kind of looking back on what it means to have been raised in this place. Able.
I heard a growl. It does feel that way. That's when I go back to even like, not just I can't sleep in the back bedroom, but 600 block on a summer evening, I get that feeling of the narrator. I guess that's the future looking part of the narrator. Like the narrator has been through the map of this landscape and there's a new map in the future, but that's sort of like post poem, post book, I suppose. And I'm left with the mystery of that, which is kind of nice, because up to the neighborhood and the city that I've been with for 50 some odd pages, really, it's so clear and so crystalline and lucid that it's exciting to kind of think on my own what's going to happen after the final page of the book.
Well, good.
You know, yeah, I'm thinking of, oh, You know, I just heard a cat ram themselves against the door. So we're getting it on both ends, and that's fine. It's just all the animals are alive with poetry today. I want to get even more specific, like, sort of like go zoom the camera in from the larger landscape into like the individual poetics of the book. And much of what you're working in is the prose poem, and like all excellent prose poems, your prose poems look kind of neat and contained and almost box-like on the surface, but that's only so that the really weird and unsettling stuff can thrive, which then for me makes the poem anything but contained. And I'm also really like, and I like how they, so I like how they function in that way. That's kind of what I look for in a prose poem, just for me as an individual, that the sense of containment so that strange things can happen inside. But then also, I like how, everything is happening at the sentence level in your prose poems, but then they're also really lyrically resonant. They've got lots of room for associative leaps. Like, when I read your prose poems, I don't feel like they should be prose. They are prose poems for me. And so I'm just wondering, and that's just my take as a reader on the prose poem itself, but I'm wondering, like, what is it about the subject matter for you that drew you to the prose poem as this book's particular form?
Well, I don't know if it was the subject matter. People, because I write a lot of prose poetry for some reason, and I don't know the reason. Because some people are always like, why do you choose prose poetry instead of lines? And I don't know the answer. I know that when I started graduate school, I submitted a portfolio that was full of line breaks, and I came out with a portfolio full of prose poems. So I'm the only thing I can think of. Someone put James Tate in front of me, and so maybe I just kind of took that and ran with it. But what I think maybe makes sense to me about the prose poem, and I guess probably works well for these kinds of poems, because I, in addition to Buick City, I just end up writing a lot about my hometown growing up, is that I'm kind of a person that I'm super introverted. I'm not really great at articulating myself when I'm speaking. And I think that I just kind of tend to be the kind of person who, like, I ask a lot of the person who I'm communicating with. So whether that's a reader or somebody I'm talking to, I tend to just, like, leave a lot of things out for no particular reason. I just make people kind of leap from one image to the next. And so I guess in the prose poem, like, that idea really works for me because it's like I want to tell you this story, but all I have are these, like, most important details. And so I'm just going to write them in this little paragraph, and then I'm just going to trust you as the reader to understand what I mean. And if you don't, then go read a poem with line breaks.
That's part of the key for me, I think, or I should say, and that's part of the key for me in your prose poems, that you're giving me just enough as a reader that I can make the discoveries on my own. You're not handing the discoveries to me, but you're also not so cryptic that I can't make discoveries, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know. I guess that's maybe the way that I became a writer is just trying to put images together, and then of course I see meaning in these images, and I hope, of course, that you cr as a poet you craft to try to create that meaning. But I think that that's what works for the prose poem for me, is that it's just kind of this little device to throw in all kinds of great images and ideas and arrange them in a way that you hope that, somebody can kind of follow them through. And I don't know, it's worked for me, and I think it worked, hope it worked for this book, but it's just kind of been what I've done, and I don't really have any logic to
And
it.
it definitely works for the book. And for folks who are coming to the book for the first time through this interview, I think that the experience of the prose poems in general in this book is that, you read them and you feel, as I said, that they've got this box-like shape so that all kinds of, when I said the weird stuff happens, I sort of meant like all kinds of discoveries can be made by the reader. And it doesn't feel like just an expository paragraph. It doesn't, and I love prose, but it doesn't feel like just, it feels like poetry. It doesn't feel like linear expository movement, And the other thing I wanted to say about the question, I loved it when you said, Well, I don't know. I did, I had this portfolio of poems with line breaks, and then I ended up with prose poems. There are times when I ask questions on the show, and I feel like, the question makes sense to me as a reader and as a writer. I mean, it feels like, a question that can lend itself to a direct answer. And then I realize in the middle of it that the person I'm speaking to is basically saying, like, I don't know, it's a mystery to me, and I don't want to mess with that mystery. So I want to say I don't want to mess with the mystery either. So
But people always ask that question because I guess they think, well, prose poetry, I think, seems mysterious to a lot of poetry fans anyway. And so they're always like, what? How do you do this? Why do you do this? And a friend of mine invited me to come speak to her class one time at Loyola, and she had read the poem The Half Trailer, which is in the book, which is like about this trailer that I actually lived in. It was divided into two apartments, and it was just a regular single wide trailer, and there was a guy that lived on the back half and I lived on the other half. And so I wrote this poem just about the experience of like sharing this wall with this guy and hearing his life going on. And she told her students, she had this whole like speech about the way that poem worked and that she saw like its boxiness as, and I say this loving her and I'm loving these insights, but it was just something I never thought of. But she was talking about like how the boxiness of the poem kind of looked like a trailer, and that like it was kind of divided in half like a half trailer. And then she like turns to me and she was like, can you talk more about that? And I was like, that's all great. I didn't do that on purpose. If that happened, all right, sounds
Yeah,
good.
thank you very much. That's a great way of looking at my poem. I know those are moments when I just have to, sort of like bow to the universe. Thank you. That was great. And I wrote it. I was one other thing I wanted to say about the prose poem. It's sort of in the theme of like readers seeing things that might not always be there, and you as the writer just saying this was the way the poem had to be, and I don't always have a logic for that. As I was reading and rereading the book, and I'm coming up with my questions, there's always a part of me when I'm thinking like, well, I don't want to ask this question or that question because it'll be an obvious question that the person gets asked all the time. And I was feeling that about the prose poems, but they're so good as prose poems. I was so into them. I thought, no, I there has to be an open door for us to talk about the prose poems. So however we went was fine. And we've kept things, some of it as a mystery too, which I think is really good. I want to, this question, I want to hear I'd like us to hear an excerpt in a second, but before we hear an excerpt, a question came to me as we were talking, and this may come out of left field, and if so, maybe I'll even edit this out. Who knows? But I don't know if you read much sort of like graphic novels or comics or anything, but the way you work with narrative reminds me of one of my favorite influences, the writer Harvey Pekar. Do you know his work?
No.
Okay, and check out his comic book series. He passed away a couple of years ago, but his comic book series was called American Splendor.
Okay.
And when I first encountered them in the 80s, and he's from Cleveland, and he writes a lot about, he was a file clerk for most of his life. He writes about what it means to live and work within what we call the working class. And he's got this sense of narrative that when I first read him, he's basically doing what your prose poems do, like giving us facts and pieces with these gaps, sort of these gaps in between the facts. And I would get to his endings, and I would expect a traditional kind of like narrative closure, like I'd get from a comic book, or for any kind of realist narrative. And instead, I would get these moments of closure, like from your poem, 600 Block on a Summer Evening. The radio says the Tigers are up by two. I think this could be a good evening. Maybe even one of the best. And it's like, there may not be a space in a handbook of how to write traditional narrative where that is how you should close a narrative, but that's how that poem has to end. And I feel that when I read his stuff. And so I like to talk about him a lot when I think of certain kinds of narrative poems. And as we were talking right now about the prose poem, it just a light went off, and I thought, oh yeah, Harvey Pekar. So American Splendor, I think you'd really like it. Well, let's hear an excerpt from the book.
Sure. I think I was having trouble kind of deciding, but since we talked about the half trailer, I think I might just read that. All right, the half trailer. When the investment firm bought the trailer park, they decided they could make more money if they remodeled the mobile homes into two rental units each, with a wall straight down the middle that separated the spaces. I shared my half trailer for about a year with a part-time hairdresser named Donna until she got picked up for trying to hire a hitman outside the Pick Quick. It took me nearly a month to notice she was gone. It wasn't long after that Jimmy came strolling through, balancing an armchair on top of a wheelbarrow and stopping every few feet to pull his jean shorts back up around his waist. That night, I came home from work and stayed awake for hours, listening to the movies he was watching, full of explosions and gunfire, underscored by the gentle rumble of his smoker's cough, the flick of his lighter, the sweet smell of his fat girlfriend's Family Dollar perfume.
That was Sarah
That was.
Carson reading from her book Buick City on Radio Free Albion. You know that the shape of that prose poem kind of reminds me of the wall of a tree. No, I couldn't resist. Sorry, that was a bad joke. Sorry. I thinking about Jimmy strolling through with the armchair on top of a wheelbarrow, and then the smoker's cough, the flick of his lighter. It makes me think of one of the questions. I want to jump right into one of the questions that was on my mind a lot when I was reading the book, or observations as I was reading the book. Because I really appreciate how the book portrays with dignity people who are living on the margins of capitalism. And some of them, and like we were saying with Harvey Pekar writing about generally being in the working class, I think that's partly why Pekar came to mind. I want to call him Harvey because I like him so much, but I've never met him. But so he's just, I feel warm towards him. But like the folks in your book, some of them are making really terrible decisions, definitely, but you represent them as fully human, which in all, really seriously, I think is a rare thing in a world that often treats poverty or working and working class life as a moral failing rather than just a failure of the system or just an effect of the system. Can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if you want to call it class conflict or class consciousness as it's manifest in the book?
Well, I think that was certainly something that was on my mind when I was writing these poems, and I still remember the very first poem I wrote in all of these book in this whole book was it's the first poem. It's called The Beginning, and I remember writing it when I was, I think I was like 19, and I was in my dorm room as an undergraduate because I just struggled so much having grown up in Flint. You know, my father, like I said, he worked at Buick City till I was about 10, and we had like a very middle class, like UAW provided life that was really great. And then factories kind of started closing. I think a lot of people have heard that narrative about Flint and Detroit, where all of a sudden the city is kind of in despair and everybody's leaving and nobody has a job anymore. And it wasn't exactly my experience, but when my father, he took an early retirement, and then all of a sudden my parents kind of divorced, and we were living below the poverty line for the first time in my life. And it wasn't bad. I mean, last night I was at a poetry reading that was about the Flint water crisis, and afterward this guy came up to me to ask me, like, he was asking me like how I grew up and how that informed my writing. And I was like, why are you asking me these questions? He was like, I just grew up, in the suburbs of Chicago, very very privileged, and I just don't have anything to write about, is what he
Oh
said.
no.
I'm like, well, I wouldn't recommend poverty just as a way to find something to write about, but
No.
when you're growing up like that, you don't I never knew really that there was a problem. I was fine. My friends and I, we did what we did. My family, we struggled, but it was a life, and it was, like you said, everything was fully human. There were bad choices, as there are bad choices across the socioeconomic spectrum. So when I went away to college and for the first time was kind of surrounded, and it was my choice of college that did this to me too, but I was for the first time really around people who had no concept of living in a city like Flint,
Yeah.
or or having those kinds of struggles. And I happened to go to an evangelical Christian college, so it kind of a little religiosity got mixed in to where it wasn't just a, like you said, moral failing. It was like, oh, you weren't a good enough person, so God has done this to
Oh
you.
no, yeah.
So it's like reckoning. I just remember being in my dorm room writing this poem, being like, you know, that narrative is not true. Like, this life is just as beautiful and, you know, a mixed bag as much as anybody else's life. And so I think that's what I wanted to do in these poems. It's been, you know, a lot of people right now are asking me to read because of the water crisis. So suddenly there's this renewed interest in hearing these poems about Flint. And I don't really have like political poems. I think that kind of disappoints people sometimes. They want to hear me like rage against, you know, the system that created poverty. But, you know, there's something just beautiful about having a family and having a neighborhood. And that's what I was trying to convey in these poems. So I definitely thought a lot about, I guess, what that would mean for people to communicate to people, like what that experience is like. If anything, I think these poems were written to kind of, as a way of kind of screaming back at the system that was telling me that that experience is somehow less than other experiences.
No, I see what you mean. I mean, and it's especially the fact that, like you said, you really started to be aware of this at college, and then you're writing poems about it. So then you're also in this art form, working in this art form that has generally been associated, like for centuries, with the aristocracy.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's really, I think that's really an important part of the book, is that, I mean, we know all of the associations that come with poetry as an art form, and you're taking that as a, you know, a vessel, an artifact, to take a particular kind of background and say it's just as fully human and dignified as any other background. And it's and it really speaks to me also as a reader, because my experiences growing up were really similar. I grew up in a city in Pennsylvania, Erie, Pennsylvania, that is, I remember when I was trying to describe Erie to a colleague of mine who's from Michigan, and I was trying to find all the right adjectives to explain how depressed it was, and she just interrupted me and said, "Oh, it sounds kind of like Flint." And I said, "Well, I've never been to Flint. I've heard about it, and you know, that doesn't seem way out as a comparison, so okay." And for me, and I'm not saying this is, when you said you're not writing, you're not seeing these as political poems, I'm not trying to put that label on them, definitely. But for me, the fact that they exist in the world as a way of giving life on or below the poverty line dignity, that feels to me almost like a political statement, not whether it was an intended or not. I'm not trying to project something that's not there, but it feels almost political to me, because we live in a culture where, you know, we don't really, I think, get a lot of realistic portrayals of the working class and what it means to grow up in a place like Flint.
Mm-hmm. No, I think they're absolutely political. But I think sometimes people hear that word and they have something else in their mind. Like, they expect you, or at least my experience, I probably shouldn't generalize like that. My experience has been that people, when you say you're from Flint, people kind of feel bad for you. They're
I
like,
see.
Oh, okay. Like, but you know, I don't feel that way. And I don't think, you know, any of my friends, well, certainly my writer friends in Flint don't feel that way. And there's been kind of a backlash recently, because there's so, just not to keep bringing up the water, but it's just been so in the news, and there's so many people interested in that story right now that lots of people are jumping on it.
Yeah.
And so they're not making adequate space for people who've lived that to tell their stories. And I think that's so important that, you know, I'm so excited to have this book in the world and be able to share like this little slice of Flint. I am not the Flint story, but you know, that's kind of the stance. If there's anything political, it's to say, you know, in within this system, you know, however it works, are people, and all systems have effects on people, I guess. Yeah.
And we all, yeah, all, in the system, there are people. All systems have an effect on people, and we all try to make our way through those systems. Yeah, and I do. I know what you mean about the. I can relate to what you're saying about the way, especially I see journalists writing about the Flint water crisis. It feels like they've discovered Flint for the very first time, and it becomes their story rather than the stories of the people who are living in it and through it. And you know, it gives me a mixed feeling because like I'm glad the story's getting out there, but I feel really unsettled too because you can see when a journalist is sort of, you know, discovering Flint becomes their object they've discovered, and it's kind of gross when it's done that way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even before water was a big thing in the news, maybe every 6 months or so. Once a year when they'd come out with like the FBI's list of the most violent cities, Flint used to always at least be in the top three, if not the top of the list. And so it would be the same experience. Maybe every 6 months or so, some journalist somewhere would see this and want to write a story about, oh my goodness, this scary city. And people just on Facebook would just explode. Like, who is this person? It would be so fun to watch all of the Flint writers kind of, to troll this person and be like, who are you? Have you even been to this town? Like, retract this now. It's interesting to see people try to take a story. I don't know if they're co-opting it for their own byline or what it is. But yeah, that's just another example, I think, of the way stories get kind of taken from the people who've lived them, I guess.
And when I see those journalistic stories, I often wonder, is the journalist going to come back and revisit the subject matter or just move on to another object later? Yeah. You know, when we were talking about the question of political poems and how people respond when they, you know, because of the way Flint is in people's consciousness, it made me think about like the way we, you know, our relationship with our readers. And, you know, often I think we're just writing completely for ourselves, but I always feel like we have readers in mind, like ideal readers. And, you know, for me, there's a cousin of mine. I don't know if Michael, if you're listening right now, you already know that you're my ideal reader, Michael, if you are listening, but you know, like we have people in mind that like, I always feel like they're on my shoulder when I'm writing. And I like to talk sometimes to fellow writers, like, do you have an ideal reader like that? If so, who are they? Or is there an ideal reader out there that's just a certain kind of person you're writing for? Do you have a sort of reader you have in mind when you're working, or is there just sort of like another direction you're taking the poem?
No, I definitely have. I don't know that it's as specific as Michael.
He's going to be so happy. He's been mentioned so many times. He loves when people talk about him. Go ahead.
That's great. But I certainly have kind of ideas of who I want a poem to communicate to, I suppose. You know, like I was talking about my experience in college, really wanting to be able to write about Flint in a way that kind of communicated maybe to more middle class or even people, you know, who just don't know the story to see that city, if I'm writing those poems, in a way that makes it human, makes it real, rather than makes it scary or sad. But I also want to really like make the people the poems are about proud when I write them. And since so many of them are mostly autobiographical or they're about people that I've met, sometimes I change names, but most often I don't. And I want people to be happy about the portrayal. So, I mean, as you mentioned, some of these poems in this book in particular really talk about kind of the crazy messed up things people do. But I still think that there's a lot of joy in those crazy things that we do.
Yeah.
So I'm always thinking, particularly with, you know, I always want my poems. I don't even know if I can say I always want my poems to be accessible. I think they are accessible because I'm just not that kind of writer I'm not a high-minded person who puts a lot of like literary illusions. I just like people to get into the story. So I think I try to write them in a way that, you know, anybody could read it and understand the story. And if you can get into the poetry of it and see it at a little bit deeper level, then that's exciting. But, you know, for the most part, I just want you to, I kind of want to just share a moment with people. And so whoever that is, I guess.
I'm thinking about when I heard you read for Columbia Poetry Review's release, I can't remember what issue it was, maybe 26 or 27. And I had that feeling of that kind of reader that you're talking about. And I know that accessible can sometimes be a dirty word in poetry circles. And it's, we sometimes like get really uneasy when that word comes out, but I really hear it as that your poems as accessible, but totally in an artful way, you know, like accessible in the way that Frank O'Hara's dailiness is acceptable or accessible. I didn't live Frank O'Hara's life. I wasn't in that New York in that time period, but his diaristic dailiness, becomes so crystal clear and lucid and real that I feel like I'm inside of it, even if there are, like I've mentioned with your prose poems, even if there are gaps between the facts that I have to fill in. It makes those gaps more exciting to fill in, and more, you know, the discovery process for me as a reader more exciting. And I think the accessible poems that don't really do anything for me are the ones where I feel I'm not given any room to discover. You know, I feel like I don't have, like the writer isn't asking me to do much of anything but just, you know, be quiet and listen or something. You know, I like to ask, we mentioned earlier at the beginning of the interview, we talked about the structure of the book and that long section, halls, flats. And I like to ask the folks I'm interviewing to talk about how one of the poems in the book came about and, you know, sort of tell us what was going on around you when you wrote the poem, you know, maybe what made this a really important poem for you. And it can be analytical, or it can also be like, you know, this is the music I was listening to when I was writing the poem. It just anything in the environment. And I'm wondering if you could talk about this in terms of Hall's Flats, which is one long poem and also one section of the book.
Sure. That is maybe the most, that's probably of all of the poems of the book, the one that has the best story, I think. I don't know if it's a good story, but it's the one with the story. So when I, because, you know, most of these are very autobiographical, so I had this job right after college. Well, I started it in college. I got a summer job working for Coca-Cola. My job was to go around to all the grocery stores in Jackson, Michigan, because that's where I was going to college, and stock, they drop off the Coca-Cola in the back room, and I would stack it on the shelves. And it was, you know, especially since I already said I was kind of struggling with class at college, it was such a break for me to go into this like world of grocery stores. Yeah. And I was the only woman. I was like 20 years old, maybe the only woman doing this work, is all these guys who, like, this was their career. Like they were happy with where they were. Uh-huh. And there was all their buddies in the back rooms. And so it was an interesting experience being young and being kind of in this, the middle of this kind of identity crisis, and meeting all these people who just, we're kind of like the people, you know, I grew up with. And so I think what ended up happening, I guess, is I kept the job. I thought I would be a Coca-Cola person for the rest of my life. I was like that done with college. I was like, I'm going to stock shelves until I'm 60. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of had this really traumatic experience where I ended up having to kind of just leave that whole life. It was like my first apartment in that half trailer, and I was just like, this is like a fun, quirky poet life in the back room of the grocery store with my half trailer. And then I just had to kind of run from it, because something bad happened. And maybe 5, 6, 7 years later, I just said to myself, you know, you need to go back to that town and kind of face like everything you just ran away from. Yeah. And so I got a hotel room. It was like over Christmas, and I had my dog with me. And I didn't go there intending to write a poem. I just kind of went and like walked around the trailer park and went and saw some old friends. And then like one night in the hotel room, I've been reading Mark Nowak's Shut Up, Shut Down.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah.
And so I was interested in like the way to use kind of found working class kind of documents in poetry. And so I kind of just sat down and wrote the whole thing as like this kind of, they kind of go back and forth. It's long poem in like sections, and it has kind of like a list of weird details from my life, mostly from my life. Some of them are embellished, but most of them are pretty factual. And then the next section will be kind of jargon from some sort of Coca-Cola world, whether it was like the application form. And I actually went online and like looked up the application and the job requirements and like the drug test form and like took all the language. And so that's the story of that poem. And it's interesting that I think just because of the story behind it, I wasn't in love with it. I'm kind of scared to do anything with it for a long time. But when this book got accepted, that wasn't actually in the book. And I said,
"That's fascinating."
I was like, I want to put this in there. She pushed back on me a little bit, but I was like, I just want it there. I think it helps like tell this story of this narrator who's, you know, navigating this existence in this kind of working class city. And so put it in there, and people, that's the one that people usually ask me about, maybe just because it's so different from the rest of the book, but it's taken on a weird little life, which is cool, I think.
Yeah, I think it really, like, it, I guess I'll push back at your editor then as a reader, because I feel like it's a really vital hinge for the first part of the book and the last part of the book. I really, as a reader, I felt like I need Hall's Flats in there to help me figure out where I've been in sections 1 and 2 and prepare me for 4 and 5. And the story you told from, you know, craft, in terms of craft, thinking about Mark Nowak, Shut Up, Shut Down, and the use of appropriation, down to the research you were doing online with the Coca-Cola applications, that found material, and the way that gets sort of put into this sort of like mesmerizing account of dailiness. But then also there's a real sense of dynamics, because there are times when I feel like the dailiness kind of implodes on itself too. And so it's not just like one long hum of appropriated material. There's a real texture to it. I think it's a key poem in the book for me.
Well, good. There you go, editor.
Well, there you go, editor. See, that's like, we've just added a footnote to the poem that's going to make your editor say, "Wow, I'm really glad I listened to Sarah. She was right." Well, let's hear another excerpt from the book.
Sure. I'll read a little section of Hall's Flats. So they're all the sections are like numbered. So I'm just going to read them through by number. This is 1. I was born in the bathtub of a 2-room trailer. In the year 2055, I will be 71. When I was small, I named puppies after ice cream. I've never seen an ocean. Sometimes I want to die, though not in the way you think. 2. Applicant must possess ability to repetitively lift, pull, and push 50-plus pounds, bend over, reach above head height, kneel, experience working with minimal supervision, ability to operate a manual-powered pallet jack or lift product, valid driver's licenses, current vehicle liability insurance, driving record within MVR policy guidelines, pallet jack certification as required. 3. My sister is 22 and has never been pregnant. My dog is afraid of kitchen tiles, lawn furniture, fruity pebbles, masking tape. When I was in high school, I was really good at making layups. My best friend works at Walgreens. My boyfriend never answers his phone. 4. I understand that I have the right to request a retest of the initial specimen. All requests for a retest of the sample must be made within 10 working days of the receipt of the original positive test result. The results of the sample must be forwarded to me by the appointing authority of the agency. 5. The guy who changes the oil in my car occasionally sends me text messages. He asks me if I want to party. I ask him what that's supposed to mean. My neighbor and his cordless phone spend all day at the window. I bought my TV in a pawn shop. I've never asked anyone for help. I don't understand the question.
You've been listening to Sarah Carson on Radio Free Albion. Sarah's most recent book, Buick City, was published by May Apple Press in 2015, and it's available everywhere you like to buy books online, including the May Apple website, mayapplepress.com, at independent sites like Small Press Distribution, spdbooks.org, and at bookstores that carry books of poetry from independent presses. You can experience Sarah's work in more detail at her blog, sarahmycarson.com. Thanks for coming on the show, Sarah. It was great to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you want to get in touch with me and tell me what you thought of today's show, my email address is tony@radiofreealbion.com. That's tony@radiofreealbion.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/radiofreealbion. Thanks again for listening.